And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. And we have an interesting show for you this morning. Our first guest, Dr. Barry Cooper, author of Alan Turing, His Work and Impact. Cooper's book covers the many ways in which Turing's scientific endeavors have impacted current research and understanding of the world. His pivotal writings on subjects include computing, artificial intelligence, cryptography, morphogenesis, new word for me, we had to look that one up, and more display continued relevance and insight into today's scientific and technological landscape.
Oh, yeah, that will be interesting. Hey, not to mention the new movie just out based on Alan Turing, The Imitation Game, and we'll speak to him about that. Good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Commander Charlie Precourt. He's a former NASA astronaut. Precourt's flight experience includes over 7,500 hours in over 60 types of civil and military aircraft. He holds commercial pilot, multi-engine instrument glider, and certified flight instructor ratings. He was the director of operations for NASA at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center in Star City, Russia, and he had responsibilities for coordination and implementation of mission operation activities in the Moscow region for the joint U.S.-Russian shuttle Mir program. We look forward to our conversation with Charlie.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, Dr. Barry Cooper, is the author of Alan Turing, His Work and Impact. During World War II, all major Nazi Germany communications were coded messages that were sent out and decoded by Nazi-engineered Enigma machines. The Enigma was capable of producing 150 million, million, million different code changes. The stakes could not be larger. Crack the Enigma, win the war. Alan Turing and his team of codebreakers at Britain's top-secret government code and cipher school did just that. Dr. Barry Cooper's with us this morning to talk to us about Alan Turing and the influence he still has today on our technological landscape. Dr. Cooper, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, good to talk to you. It's amazing to be able to talk to you across all this distance. It's a different world to what Turing knew.
Absolutely.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Now, unless you're a World War II buff or a computer scientist, you may not have heard of Alan Turing. So can you take a moment and tell us who he was and why he's still of interest today?
Yeah, I guess primarily he was a mathematician, and throughout his life he had described himself like that. But the actual incidents and features of his life, you couldn't have made it up. It was extremely interesting and remarkable. He, as a young man, about 24, I guess, in 1936, he had a small paper published called On Computable Numbers, and what was in that paper was to have a huge effect on all sorts of science and computer science later on. I guess most people, at least in the UK anyway, know Alan Turing for his for what you were talking about, which is the decrypting of the German codes in Bletchley Park, and the impact that had on the war, that shortened it supposedly by 2 years probably, and may even have made the difference between the war being won and lost. And then after Bletchley Park, I guess he did really seminal work on artificial intelligence and, as you were commenting on, the patterns in nature. The sort of work on it's quite remarkable. You know, when you think that if you look at the patterns on a zebra's back or on a tropical fish or whatever, do you think of mathematics? Well, very few people would, but Turing was one of that select band, and the work that came out of it, that's one of his most influential areas, which was fed into medicine and various other areas.
He was certainly wired in a different way than most people. I can only imagine how difficult it was to crack Enigma,
yes.
And putting that machine together was, I mean, a person couldn't beat Enigma, but if you build the right machine, it could, and he did that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when he went to Bletchley Park, he brought knowledge of statistics for a start. He'd done quite important work in statistics, and also he brought the kind of the idea of using machines to aid the search for particular, the codes that needed to be broken were, as you said, involved huge numbers of alternatives, and you needed ingenuity to bring down the number of alternatives, but then you needed machines to deal with that kind of large amount of data.
It's very interesting. If Turing were alive today, imagine what he would bring us. He was just so much a man before his time, really. I guess we could call him the first computer scientist, really.
Yeah, he was ahead of his time in various ways, this is partly the reason why he's not so well known in the short term, and only in recent times has he been getting more knowledge of what he did and more credit for the outcomes. But he's had a huge impact on the modern world, and this has been recognized around the world, I think, and nowhere more than by the Association for Computing Machinery in America. In 2012, they had a meeting in San Francisco, which was attended by 700 people, and it was probably the largest meeting celebrating Alan Turing's centenary that year.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that we don't often know that, like as John says, that unless you're a World War II buff, you don't know that it was Turing's contribution that ended the war, essentially. It's strange that we don't know that. And yet here we are, and I'm thinking also of the physicist Nikola Tesla, who we didn't really know about until we started.
Who was another very innovative person, yes.
Yes, yes. And then it is somehow popular culture that brings these people to us. And by popular culture, I'm referring to the electric car, the Tesla, right, named
yes,
for him.
Yes. Yes.
And now this movie that one of my favorite actors is the star of, who plays Turing, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and the movie The Imitation Game. So soon American audiences will be very well exposed to Turing.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a great event, actually, the movie coming out, because it will make Turing's work and life much better known, and it's amazing that this has actually happened. I think, if you've gone back 10 years, you couldn't have imagined a movie about such a kind of arcane subject as the mathematics of Alan Turing, and I think the movie makers have done a great job in making it approachable, by everybody, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. My son is a computer science major college, and I just texted him this morning and asked him if he knew of Alan Turing. He said, "Oh yeah, we study him all the time. We know so much about
amazing.
Him." Yeah,
absolutely. That's amazing. Great.
Yeah, it's good to know. And I think that because of figures like, say, Mark Zuckerberg, for example, and really the pop
Yeah, I saw a photograph of him with various members of the cast of the movie and Harvey Weinstein as well in the picture. It was quite encouraging, really. I mean, for those of us who would like to see the film be a big success, you know, it's nice to see this kind of support.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Dr. Barry Cooper, who has written Alan Turing, His Work and Impact. You quote Time magazine in your book, and I'll just read the quote quickly.
Oh, right. Yes, from 2000, yes.
The fact remains that everyone who taps at a keyboard, opens a spreadsheet, or a word processing program is working on an incarnation of a Turing machine. He's just had a lot of influence, and people are still studying his math.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, what people sometimes forget, which if you look into the book, you know, at Turing's 1936 paper, you'll see that actually the key idea is the universal Turing machine, you know, which is that the stored program feature of the modern computer is incredibly important. The fact that we don't have to modify the hardware, you know, when we want the computer to do different jobs, we just feed in data in the form of programs, and we can get our computer to do many different jobs, a whole range, anything that we can do on one machine, we can do on a different machine, because they're all incarnations of the universal Turing machine.
Dr. Cooper, what is meant by the term universal computation?
Well, universal, it is really just this feature that you can treat the programming of the computer as data. There were programmable computers earlier, but it involved using special methods of inputting, you know, of changing the program. You know, you might have a plug board and change wiring and so on. But the universal feature means that your software can be updated remotely. You know, I can have Apple software on my computer, and they without me even knowing about it, they have the feature of updating my systemware if I want to remotely, and that means it's universal in the sense that the logical structure of the machine can be changed in the form of data rather than in the form of hardware.
Going to the book, you have one contributor to the book, and of course there are various in this book.
Yes.
Is about 5 pounds in weight. It's a huge volume.
Right.
It looks like it would take up an entire year at a university course.
Yes, it's not what you call light reading.
I know, and I can't wait to give it to my son. I'll go, here's your Christmas present.
Right.
But one of the contributors muses, as you say, that the internet was maybe even in the throes of its design by Turing. So maybe it turns out Al Gore didn't invent the internet after all.
Well, I have to say that Turing did made amazing contributions. It's sometimes stretched a little too far. I think the internet. I think he was visionary in the sense that he did. He had a thing called the Oracle Turing machine, which kind of predated interactive computers. But I think the internet, you know, that was part of the history that followed. And of course, Turing died in 1954, and it was sometime after that the internet was in its detail materialized.
Yeah, just a few years after that.
Yes, a few years. Yeah.
Now, speaking of his death, Turing died at the age of 42 and a very sad 41.
It was just a few days before his 42nd birthday.
Right. Committed suicide in a very sad, very tragic turn of events. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, okay. It's a sad end, and it's not something that the UK is especially proud of, and it's something that It's something that can't be it's history that can't be rectified. Mm-hmm. But Alan Turing was also gay, and nowadays, of course, this is part of personal liberties that people's sexuality mm-hmm. is their own affair as long as it doesn't injure anybody else. And Alan Turing in 1952. He was burgled, and in the process, the police talking to him discovered that he was gay, and he was prosecuted for it. So that was how the law was in the UK at that time, and the outcome of this was that he had the alternative of a prison sentence or being treated with hormones in those days they would have thought it as curing or at least changing the person that he was. And this intervention had a dramatic effect on him. And apart from the embarrassing physical effect, it probably clouded his thinking, so that his science, which was really his life in a sense, was invaded and degraded by the treatment that he got from the British authorities. And and then in just 2 years later, he was dead. He, as I say, in 1954, he committed suicide, as we believe. Of course, there's a slight doubt about whether it was suicide or an accident or something else.
Very sad.
I don't know what else I should say about that.
It tells a story.
It was a very tragic end to a brilliant man.
Yeah, I mean, again, he was born into the wrong time, wasn't he?
Yeah, ahead of his time again, yeah. Once again, I mean, when you think how the world's changed now, I mean, not everywhere, you know, I mean, but the UK and the US and so on, individual liberty has been broadened tremendously since the 1950s.
Dr. Cooper, you're the professor of mathematical logic at the University of Leeds in
England, yes.
And the president of the Association of Computability in Europe.
Yes.
How did you start with your interest in Alan Turing and you know, writing this book? I mean, it's quite a project. It must have taken some time.
Well, the book here, the book, of course, was a huge task, and in the end, it was 18 months late of being delivered to Elsevier. And I was working overnight on it many times, and it was a great piece of great labor at the time. But originally, I think I just got into Alan Turing's work. I think it was his mathematics. And one thing he did in 1936, which is often overlooked, is that the reason why he came up with this model of what computation was. Was that he was approaching an old open problem of David Hilbert, and the problem was essentially saying whether there were unsolvable problems or not, and by mathematically formulating what it meant for a problem to be solvable, he was able to show that there were unsolvable problems. And that is something that I was working on. That was my speciality, was the analysis of incomputable information. And so that was a pure mathematical interest at the time. But then when I went to Manchester as a PhD student, I learned more about Turing, and I heard, you know, I got to know his only PhD student, Robin Gandy, who was a professor at Manchester at that time. And I learned more about Turing. Of course, it wasn't until recently that I guess when I read Andrew Hodge's biography of Turing, I got to know more about the person. And then it became clear to me how much the personal character of Turing was tied up with the science. And the science for Turing, I think, was part of him finding himself as a person. And what he contributed to the science came very much out of who he was. And then, of course, when one kind of engages with this rather kind of intriguing and powerful package, the Turing and his work, then one gets gripped the science is fascinating, and then Turing's adventure becomes kind of universal in a sense. It kind of reflects for many of us on our own struggles to succeed and survive in the world, and particularly in the social context, I think. And Turing's become an iconic figure for many people. And if I can say, just say a little bit more. If you see the interviews with the actors and the director of The Imitation Game, you can see that they've been gripped as well by this this kind of interesting and engrossing person, and they're not just they're not just making a movie, but it's kind of an important contribution, if you like, to the Turing legacy and to culture more generally, I think.
Yeah, and Lynn and I are big supporters of STEM curriculum and those sorts of things. We're hoping that more kids will see this movie and will be inspired. And speaking of the movie, since you know so much about him, how close is The Imitation Game to the real man?
Oh, that's a really it's a really nice question, because there's some discussion about historical accuracy and things, and I think the movie makers, particularly the script writer Graham Moore, I think he's done a tremendous job, and what he did, I think, is he committed himself to who Turing was. And an overview of the kind of the character of his science, rather than the kind of the detail that you get in the book. And what they've done is they've changed small items of history. They kind of rearranged the people involved in Turing's group and so on. And but they've done this in the interests of an overarching higher view of who Turing was and the work that he did and so on, and I think they've done this magnificently, and the service that they've done to the Turing legacy is quite amazing, and I've seen the film twice, by the way, I should say, so I'm trying not to spoil anything, also I should say that Benedict Cumberbatch was a great choice for Turing. I mean, physically he's not terribly close to Turing, but psychologically and in his kind of dedication to bringing the real Turing, into the movie, I think he's done an amazing job.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of his from Sherlock, and so as I saw his name, I thought, oh, that's perfect. And apparently he's related by blood, accordingly, to Turing, a 17th cousin or something.
Yes, I'm not sure how impressed we should be by that, because I think if somebody counted up the number of 17th or less cousins, they might find
that's right.
quite a lot of them.
Yeah, of course. You go back far enough, we're all related, right?
By the way, I should just mention, I mean, without going into detail, Turing was a rather geeky sort of person, and I think Cumberbatch does well in representing such people. But it's fantastic. Maybe Turing's partly responsible for this, but geekiness has become... it's become
fashionable.
Trendy, it's actually in, and so you can see it in the media all over the place now, that the science and the computer science, is really quite respectable. And when you look back into the past, like the hard times that, thoughtful kids had at school, it's nice to see like icons like Turing and Cumberbatch, entering the popular culture.
That's right.
So Lynn made a reference to Sherlock, and I just want to tell everybody that if you have not seen Sherlock, Cumberbatch was the star of the last Star Trek film.
He was the
antagonist, and he had superhuman strength, and he was like pretty smart too.
Oh right! Oh, I didn't see that. No.
I think Star Trek trumps Sherlock. That's just my own personal opinion.
Right. Okay. Actually, I tell you what. When it comes to the movie, there's a lot of personal opinion about this, and I think overall the reception has been extremely favourable. But I would say that Benedict Cumberbatch has had universal, I think, appreciation. I haven't seen a critical review of what he did in that movie. So it's great that it happened anyway.
All right. Well, not only are you doing a great job representing touring, but you're doing a great job representing the movie. So I can't wait to see it, really. Hey, just a final question for you. Every time I've read about the German encryption machine, the Enigma, I always wonder why it was called the Enigma. Do you know?
Oh, wow. Do I know the answer?
It's such a great word. I've always loved that word, but...
I think it may have come from the German. I looked that up in Andrew Hodges' book. That's a detail to brush up on. I think it came from the German, and I'd have to check that. It's very of course it's very appropriate.
It is, yeah.
Yes, and of course it's applied to Turing himself because he didn't leave any diary or. And there's lots of things we don't know about Turing because, you know, I guess he was a fairly private person and didn't give all his secrets away.
Dr. Barry Cooper, we want to thank you so much for joining us from England this morning.
It was good to talk to you. Yes, it's amazing. I have been to Salt Lake City, and I went through in a Greyhound back in 1973, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
Back when, people still rode Greyhounds.
Right.
Yes. Oh, right. You mean they don't exist? All right.
Okay. No, they do. Yeah. They do.
All right.
So, yeah. Dr. Barry Cooper, author of Alan Turing, His Work and Impact. Thank you again for joining us.
Good to talk to you. Yes. Bye.
Thank you.
When we return, we will speak with Commander Charlie Precourt, former NASA astronaut. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City. Only on KPCW.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Nexus IT is proud to support Cool Science Radio and KPCW. Nexus IT provides complete cloud computing solutions to streamline and simplify your business, IT processes, and logistics. 435-487-9099. NexusITC.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we were just speaking with Dr. Barry Cooper. He had edited a book about Alan Turing, and wow, fascinating. Again, if you were listening to us talk about the movie just out, it's called The Imitation Game. And I think it's out in theaters all over. I'm not sure if it's in Park City. I should have looked that up before. Do you know?
I'm not sure if it's out yet. I think it'll be out in the next week or so, but maybe it's out. I'm not sure.
Well, at least Mark Zuckerberg had a private screening of the movie, so he's seen it.
He has seen it.
We weren't invited to that. Imagine. All right. Our next guest is Commander Charlie Precourt, former NASA astronaut. Precourt's flight experience includes over 7,500 hours and over 60 types of civil and military aircraft. He holds commercial pilot, multi-engine instrument, glider, and certified flight instructor ratings. He was selected by NASA in January of 1990 and became an astronaut in 91. He flew in four shuttle missions, and among many other responsibilities, he was the director of operations for NASA at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center in Russia in the late 90s, with responsibility for coordination and implementation of mission operations and activities in the Moscow region. We don't have him on the phone just yet, but I will say that he now is with ATK, and he's the vice president and general manager of their Space Launch Division. Now, ATK is located all over the place, but in right here in Utah as well. So I'm not sure if we'll be speaking to Charlie Precourt here in Utah or not, but we have him joining us by phone now. Good morning to you. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on Cool Science.
Well, Charlie Precourt, it's a pleasure to have you, and wondering if you are located here in Utah now that you're with ATK.
I am. However, I'm not there this morning. I travel quite a bit for the company, and today I'm up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
The weather's about the same.
Yeah, I bet. Is it about single-digit weather temperature?
Yeah, it got cold.
Yeah, very good. I think there's snow there, however. Well, Mr. Precourt, talk a little bit, if you would, first about ATK before we get into our space program. You know, we used to know it as Thycle, and even before that, maybe Hercules. And we know now that it's building the mirrors for the James Webb Space Telescope. And because I think it's out in the West Desert, we don't know too much about it here in Utah. Can you just explain a little bit about the company?
Sure. Well, ATK originally was a spinoff of Honeywell back in 1990, and Honeywell's headquarters is up in Minneapolis, and so ATK originally had its headquarters in Minneapolis. Today, it's actually out in Washington, D.C., but as a spinoff of Honeywell, it became focused on defense systems, and it acquired other companies like both Hercules and Thycle. So ATK is, a manufacturing, aerospace and defense manufacturing-focused company, very, very highly skilled in manufacturing of high-technology equipment. And so what a lot of people in Utah recognize as Thycle is part of ATK today. What was Hercules is part of ATK today, but so are other places in other states around the country. As you mentioned, the backplane for the James Webb Telescope, the structure that holds the mirror stable, was built by our composites experts in Magna, Utah, and part of a division that builds solar arrays. We have a division also in Utah that builds composite structures for aircraft like the new Airbus A350. We have a lot of ammunition and missile technology that's manufactured back east in Virginia and Maryland, and we have, as I said, manufacturing plants virtually all over the country. But I think it's about 23 different states today. So it's quite a conglomeration today, as compared to what folks knew as just Thycle or here at Hercules in Utah. And yet Utah remains with focus on large solid rocket motors and composite structures. It remains a big center of business for the ATK company, and I run the division that does solid propulsion for NASA and for DOD and so forth. So a lot of good work with a lot of good people with very high technology capabilities.
Hmm. So as a veteran of four space flights, is this what a retired astronaut does?
Well, you know, as varied as the astronaut corps expertise is in terms of where we recruit astronauts from, the careers that they pursue afterwards are just as varied. The astronaut corps is made up of former military test pilots as well as scientists, engineers, doctors, scientists of many, many different disciplines from academia, from industry, from the military, a lot of high technology expertise and a broad spectrum of discipline. And so because of that variety of their expertise, when they and they decide to stop flying and pursue further career ambitions. Some stay within NASA and NASA management. I did that for a little bit. Others go back to industry. Some go back to academia and take positions in universities. Others start private businesses. So it's quite a bit of variety there as well.
Commander, you were the on the first shuttle mission to connect with the Mir program, the Russian shuttle Mir program. And it's interesting, you have a relationship with Russia that continues. I mean, back during the Cold War, you would fly on one side of the Iron Curtain, and in a MiG-23, a Soviet MiG-23, Vasily Soplyov would fly in the other, and you and he became good friends. Can you tell us about that relationship and how you worked together?
Yeah, it was, for me, it's probably one of the more significant events and change of events in my life in a real positive way. I was an F-15 pilot in the early 80s and stationed in Bitburg, Germany, a base which is now closed, but it was prior to the wall coming down, obviously, and our role in the F-15 was to maintain superiority of the skies over the NATO territories, and we were kept on alert. Those aircraft were maintained on alert status to be able to be in the air 24/7 within 5 minutes of an issue arising. And we'd often find ourselves scrambled to the border with East Germany and get there and look across the other side, and there would be a MiG aircraft wagging its wings. And as typical of the Cold War, never a shot was fired, but we'd turn away from each other wagging wings and, you know, off we'd be to the next day, and it was a stalemate for many years until the wall came down, and the president invited the Russians to join us in space exploration with an agreement to have an American fly to Mir and several astronauts to fly on shuttle missions. And that grew into a series of 7 flights to take Americans to and from the Mir space station. As you say, I was privileged to be the pilot for the first docking that we flew of the shuttle to the Mir space station, and one of the commanders of the missions for the Russians for the missions on board Mir was Vasily Soplyov. And when I first met him, we got to talking about our previous careers because we recognized each other as military test pilots, and lo and behold, he'd been in East Germany at the same time I had been in West Germany flying F-15s. And what a dramatic opening to understand his and his family's and his colleagues' dreams, aspirations, and way of life, and to become really good friends with him and his family and colleagues was really, really a rewarding experience. And so we flew together on the Mir in 1997, I guess it was. And he had quite a few incidents. There was a fire on board the Mir, and I took supplies up to the Mir to help them recover from that. Later, there was a collision with a supply craft, and I returned to the Mir on a subsequent mission on shuttle to again help them recover from that. So,
wow.
quite a streak of events there that people probably don't recall from the mid-90s when we started collaborating with the Russians.
And was it on one of those restocking missions or repairing missions that when Vasily was still in the space station, and you talk about and you show a picture as you tell the story about you returning to Earth while he stays back on the space station. And I don't know, it just hit me when I pictured you leaving your friend and him sort of seeing you airborne going back to Earth. It just and it's a beautiful picture too, the plasma trail left.
It's that particular photograph is pretty stunning because it's taken from the perspective of somebody on the space station, but as we return in the shuttle in those days from the space station, we're in the same orbit as the station. Obviously, we've left the station, we're headed back to Earth, so when we descend, we get out in front of the space station, and as we enter the Earth's atmosphere, the heating from the friction of reentry causes this hundreds and hundreds of miles long plasma trail that's quite visible, and they were able to take that picture of the shuttle re-entering the atmosphere ahead of them. Just a striking image for him to be watching us re-enter at 17,000 miles an hour. Just very, very striking image.
Commander Precourt, tell us about here on Earth how space flight inspires us.
So the challenge we have when we talk about space flight is how it is such a broadly impacting activity that it's not the same, hasn't the same meaning for every one of us, but it has some meaning for each of us. And so if you're a scientist, you're mostly interested in exploring the universe and understanding the origins of the universe. If you're an engineer, you love the idea of being involved in building the next great machine. If you're a pilot or an explorer, you want to go where no one's been before. But if you're involved in other activities not directly related to it, it has also incredible meaning in that it provides inspiration to our children to pursue education and careers that they might not otherwise have thought but that were open to them. It inspires our industrial base to produce better and more reliable and more cost-effective machinery, and it also raises the bar for those on the factory floor who are building parts to send people to space. They recognize that the part they're holding in their hands is going to enable and protect a crew member to go do something that hasn't been done before. That's pretty inspirational to them. It also inspires us as a world leader to bring international partners into a collective, ambitious program to pursue things that hadn't been done before, and to do it collectively and collaboratively in an international partnership is something that is not available to other activities as much as it is for space exploration. So just the landing yesterday on the comet by the European Space Agency involved an incredible amount of international collaboration. So space exploration touches all of us, and I've always spoken about it as the key common linkage is inspiration, something that inspires everyone in some way because of the fact that we try to do something we hadn't thought possible.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you think, as a former astronaut, that we do enough in the, you talk about in 47 states there are parts built for our space program. And, does the average worker on the floor that's making the whatever little widget that puts together this great machine, do they know, or do we do enough to really spread that inspiration throughout the whole, everyone involved?
Actually, I think that we can always do more. There are great initiatives internal to the, in this case, NASA and the industrial team, where when I was active as an astronaut, I would often travel to factories around the country and make a presentation to an employee who had been chosen by his or her peers and managers as having done something significant to foster improved safety for the astronauts. So we had an award that we called the Silver Snoopy. There's a little image of Snoopy, the Charles Schulz character, in a spacesuit on a small silver pin. Hmm. It was inspired by the Apollo astronauts to take to employees and award to them on the factory floor for having done something that enhanced safety of spaceflight. And so we get out and do programs like that raise the awareness that they can be in one of these 47 states and maybe never have a chance to get to a launch, but they can still touch the program and they can have the program come to them. And the more of that kind of thing that we can do, obviously, the more it has impactful meaning for everyone, but we can always do more.
I remember years ago when Commander Gus Grissom from the original Mercury 7 made a comment that he was sitting on top of a candle with 10,000 contractors who were all awarded their business based on best price, and that made him a little uncomfortable.
That's right. How do you feel about this? Well, knowing that all of the parts on here went to the lowest bidder kind of makes me wonder. That is an ongoing challenge for the way we manage programs like this. But
and Life magazine worked so hard to manage everything that came out of the astronaut's mouth back in the Mercury days. And you just couldn't hold Gus back, could you?
Nope, that's right.
I think you and I have sort of a similar background in that you grew up in Hudson, Massachusetts. I grew up outside of Hudson, maybe 15, 20 minutes away in Acton. And and I read and just took in everything, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And you were born in 55. I was born in 52. And so we probably had that fascination at the same time.
I think that's probably right. You probably recall, as I do, that frequently there would be something on the front page of the paper that described how NASA was going to make the next mission happen. We didn't have internet. We didn't have computers to go look things up. We relied on what came out in the papers or on the black and white TVs of the day with, you know, three major channels and a PBS station to get some limited information. We were all hungry for it when it came, and it was just fascinating to see how they were going to. I remember pictures on the front of the paper were the Earth and the Moon and sketches of transfer orbits to take the vehicles from the Earth to the Moon and how they were actually going to accomplish the landing and so forth. It was just something we're all hungry for, because it's so fascinating.
Mm. Our guest is Charlie Precourt. He's a former astronaut, a veteran of four space flights. And I have to just ask you before we let you go, you're a huge proponent of Mars exploration. And aside from that theme of our space program inspires us, why is it important to go to Mars?
I think about Mars as a logical continuum of exploration. And by that, what I mean is, if you think back to what we've done, it's easy to look at any one program and say, you know, the shuttle went and repaired the Hubble Space Telescope, or the shuttle built the space station. Snapshots in time don't give you the context of the longer-term human desire to explore. If you take it in big chunks of time, Mercury was about figuring out, could we put a human in space beyond the atmosphere, have him survive, and get him home? Gemini, once we learned that Mercury could answer that question, Gemini became, okay, can we do something productive in space? Can we maneuver the spacecraft such that we could perform dockings and refuelings? Could we do, orbital changes and perfect reentry and just the mechanics of operation such that we could then extrapolate those experiences to go into the moon? And so Gemini gave us the ability to do those kinds of things. We'd need to go to the moon. Then Apollo took us to the moon and showed that we could get to the moon's surface and get back safely. It was not enabling yet a permanent presence, however. And so given the logical progression, you look at shuttle and space station as now being able to allow us to exploit being in space for research and technology development on a permanent basis. So then you look at, okay, so what is the next continuum beyond that? Permanent presence is in a low Earth orbit. Think about permanent exploration on another planetary body as providing an enriching amount of access to new knowledge. Much like we have an outpost in Antarctica 24/7, imagine the knowledge we can bring home with an outpost on the surface of Mars. So this is a continuum of exploration through the decades, and it becomes the next logical step for us. And as happened throughout all those other programs, we don't really know the sum total of, and we can't expect to know the sum total of discovery, but we know from experience that by exploring, we do discover, and it brings positive benefits. So I think it's a natural next evolutionary step for us.
That was a great answer. Thank you for that. And Charlie Precourt, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. And hey, if you get lonely out there in the West Desert of Utah or in Magna, wherever you are, come and visit us in Park City.
Be delighted to. Looking forward to some good skiing this winter.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Commander.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Well, just I'm sort
I'm
of
ready
blown
to go
away.
To Mars.
Oh yeah, just fantastic. Hey, we'll return after these messages, and we will have today's cool story.
Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801. PeakArtAndFrame.com.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. First, want to thank our guest today, Dr. Barry Cooper, on that wonderful book about Alan Turing, and also Charlie Precourt, former astronaut. And wow, what an interesting, fascinating. It really does explain our space program and why, you know?
Very exciting.
Why not?
Very exciting. And we love STEM curriculum, and we want to see more people involved in that. And I think yesterday's event is probably going to help to make that happen. Today's cool story is European Space Agency has landed a craft on the surface of a comet 380 million miles away. The comet was only spinning away at about 40,000 miles per hour, and we have landed a spacecraft there, and we are going to be over the next couple of years getting all sorts of great data.
Yeah, and so our little, apparently a tiny little thing called Philae. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
It landed on the comet, and it has 10 instruments that have now begun 64 hours of scientific operations before its batteries drain. Of course, there's no way to recharge out there. Well, they do have solar panels that will recharge the batteries, but just allow intermittent operation. So
right.
Really, it's in the next couple months where they're going to get a bunch of information.
So 4.5 billion years ago, when the solar system formed, they think that Earth was just made up of a bunch of rocky bits that came together to form the planet. But no one really knows where the oceans came from. They suspect that they came from collisions of comets into the Earth that was carrying ice that formed our oceans. But they don't know for sure. That is the fundamental question that they are going to try to answer.
Right. Now, what about when this Philae landed on the comet? It apparently bounced somewhat. It was supposed to have these little legs that would extend down to grip. What is it? Is it an icy surface or?
Well, it's a surface that's moving and that's not stable. And they had these thrusters that were supposed to push Philae into the surface. And then the pylons were supposed to come in and screw themselves in. But the thruster didn't fire, and then the pylons couldn't grab a hold on its own, so it bounced for 2 hours.
Wow! But didn't come apart.
Well, we hope it didn't.
That's fascinating.
I mean, we know that it's sending information now. We're hoping that the solar panels were not damaged.
Hey, I just want to say something. First of all, Charlie Precourt gives a great TED Talk from April of this year, and he shows a couple of images from space, and one of those is an image from Mars looking back at Earth. And I can't even describe to you the visceral feeling I got from looking at this. I mean, it's just like we're looking out in space, and we see some planet way out there, and to think that there's actually an entire that it's Earth, that it's us and everything we do and inhabit and all of our systems and our ecosystems, such a little tiny blob away. I don't know. It just gave me this feeling of, it was kind of scary.
And the iconic photo of the first Earth rise from the moon back in, Christmas Eve of 1968.
Yeah, you see those and they really hit you in the gut. Hey, let's take one more quick break and then we'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And we are back. This is Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. And we want to thank our sponsors, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. You're listening to KPCW Park City.